In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Dr. Peter Kramer. He is a psychiatrist and probably is best known, has become known, for a book that he wrote now 12 years ago, a book that helped to touch off a lot of debate and discussion about the use of antidepressant medications. And that book was titled Listening to Prozac. And it began with his experiences, his discussion of experience, treating some of his patients who have depression and found that, indeed, some of them were dramatically better off after taking these medicines. And he went on from there to ask some questions about the power that these medicines might have to improve the lives of people who never experienced depression, whether, in fact, the use of these kinds of medicines on that basis would be appropriate or desirable. And as a result of all of the attention that the book received and that he received, he became something of a specialist, called upon frequently to comment on depression. Sometimes people who had very serious depression sought him out, hoping that he could help. And he ended up spending a lot of time talking about and thinking about depression. And all of that led one way or another to eventually to a book, a new book, one that is now just out, which is entitled Against Depression, which takes a look at the mechanisms of depression, something of how it occurs, what happens in the brain to people who experience it, and his argument that we should certainly take it seriously, that people should think of it as a disease, and it's the kind of thing that we should aggressively work to treat. And he, in fact, in the book, asks a basic question. He says, if we could eradicate depression completely so that no human being ever experienced it again, would we? And if we did, would we somehow be losing something? We will get his answers to those questions and invite yours as well in this part of the show. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good any place that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point, calls are certainly welcome. Our guest, Peter Kramer, has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Slate, Salon, U.S. News and World Report, among other periodicals. He lives and practices in Providence, Rhode Island, where he's clinical professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. He's also host of a public radio program called The Infinite Mind. It's a weekly show that explores what we know about the human mind and goes out to something like a million people across the nation. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Kramer, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Nice introduction.
Well, we very much appreciate you giving us some of your time. Do you think that even though now we seem to be more willing to talk about depression, and there's a lot in popular media about it, and people are willing to say that they have experienced it, and people are also willing to say that they're taking medication. Given all of that, though, do you think that somehow we have not taken depression seriously enough?
I don't think we've taken the measure of it. I think this book is built around a very simple question. Most of my books are, which is, we say depression is a disease. Well, all right, you know, what does that mean? Are we willing to give it real, full standing as a disease? And in particular, the kind of disease that it appears to be, that is a progressive disease where the later episodes are worse, harder to treat, longer lasting, involve more symptoms than the earlier ones, a disease that is harmful to the brain. Are we willing to see depression for what it is, and why is that so controversial? Why, if the medical societies and the public health campaigns and so on say depression is a disease, does there remain enormous resistance to actually treating depression as a disease in our ordinary daily habits of thought?
Hmm. Well, just to be sure, as a physician or as a psychiatrist, when you use the word disease, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means what we mean colloquially. That is, it means, you know, it's the word that unites cancer and multiple sclerosis and nephritis and acne and, you know, cavities of the teeth and allergies and asthma. And, you know, these conditions are harmful. They have some pathology in the body. They cause pain and suffering. And they, you know, not everyone, but draw from a number of other pools of characteristics, that is, they run in families, often they're progressive. A subset of them involve abnormalities in functions that ordinarily are helpful, but when they occur to excess, become harmful. So the autoimmune diseases, you know, we're able to attack a virus or a bacterium, but if that response continues too long, then we start attacking our own cells. And depression has all those characteristics. You know, it's partly genetic. It looks like it is a stuck switch in the stress response system, so that these stress responses that would be appropriate and helpful in the case of an acute challenge get turned on too long. There are changes in the brain. It causes terrible suffering. It causes great financial loss throughout the culture. So it looks like an ordinary disease in the way that we would use that word in any other case. In fact, a culture that had no category of mental illness and where the mental suffering of depression were not taken into account would still count depression as a disease based on what we now know about depression's downstream effects on the heart and blood vessels and blood elements and the brain and so on. Depressed people die at every age more than people without depression. And they mostly die not of suicide, but of things like stroke and heart attack. So this chronic stress response affects a number of organs. Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps we should say how doctors diagnose depression. I don't know if we want to spend a minute doing that.
Sure.
So we know just what we're talking about. There's something called a depressive episode, which is if you have 2 weeks of five symptoms from a group of nine, and one of the symptoms you have to have is either extreme sadness or inability to hope and experience pleasure and look forward to things. So one of those two symptoms and enough others to add up to five. And if they're moderate and, you know, strong enough to cause interference with your ordinary functioning, then you have depression. And the symptoms include things like sleep and appetite changes, guilty ruminations, suicidality, problems with memory and concentration. So that's how you get a depressive episode. And then if you have a depressive episode, you qualify for one of a number of mood disorder diagnoses. And the main one is major depression, which is really a extension or recurrence of these depressive episodes. And the two-week cutoff is a statistical phenomenon. That is to say, when you go out and interview people, if they have those 2 weeks of depression, it really predicts that they're going to have 6 months or 9 months, or they're already in a depressive episode, or they're in their third episode, and their relatives have more depression than the general population. So the 2 weeks, it isn't that if depression only lasted 2 weeks, it would be the kind of disease we're talking about. It's that 2 weeks is an indicator of an ongoing disease.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that even though people accept the language of disease in association with mental illness, that the idea that depression, for example, is a disease in the sense that diabetes is a disease or that cancer is a disease, and people will readily agree to that, and yet at the same time, there seems to be some difficulty with them accepting, in fact, and thinking about it in that way. Perhaps that is not surprising, because even within the field of psychology, there has been a debate, and I think that it's still a continuing debate, as to the nature of mental illness. And there are people who I think would be prepared to argue that, in fact, mental illness is not, it's not like diabetes or cancer or any
right.
other disease, that there is something about it that makes it different. And I suppose it's that something that's also a little bit difficult to define.
Well, I think it is difficult to define. I had a very well-known neurologist, a woman whose book I had read, very fine book, who showed up at a signing for Against Depression. And at the end of the discussion, she said, "I can't put my finger on it, but I still resist the idea." You know what I mean? That mm-hmm. she didn't have a cogent argument, but she had a sort of visceral resistance. And I think we do. I think, you know, a patient of mine very typically will come in and say, "Oh, my neighbor has diabetes. He's losing his vision. How can he bear it? He has this chronic progressive disease." And I'll say, "Well, you have a chronic progressive disease." But even if she has accepted that at some level, maybe taking medication for the depression, At another level, she doesn't put it in the same category that she puts her neighbor's diabetes. And parenthetically, her depression will be more disabling than his diabetes. In fact, you know, if you look around the world at what the disabling diseases are, and the World Health Organization has done this, to the surprise of the researchers, and now it's no longer a surprise, always depression is at the top of the list. It's the top of the list in developing countries, developed countries. The only conditions that are more disabling on a population basis than depression are things like infantile diarrhea, which is, you know, 30 diseases lumped together, where, you know, if you get that in a developing nation, you die young and you lose, you know, 80 good years of your life. But if you look at the number of days lost to depression, even in the developing world, it's a very, very important disease. But we don't think of it in that way. And as I say, even patients who are coming to be treated by a doctor for this don't always see it that way. And I certainly heard this when I went to talk about listening to Prozac. People would say, you know, what if Van Gogh had gotten Prozac? What if antidepressants had been available in Van Gogh's time? And if you think about it, I mean, implicit in that question is that something would have been lost, that we should have been hesitant to give Van Gogh Prozac. And Van Gogh didn't have some mild condition that we can debate over. Van Gogh had something clearly serious. He was self-destructive with it. He died, you know, from the outflow, from the result of it. He probably didn't have depression. He was thought in his lifetime that he had epilepsy. Some modern neurologists think Van Gogh had epilepsy as well. And sometimes I would discuss with audiences, well, why don't we say, what if anticonvulsants had been available? You know, drugs against epilepsy had been available in Van Gogh's time. Why is that a less amusing question than what if Prozac had been available? And there are some reasons we could discuss why that is, but I think among the reasons that we're willing to joke more about depression is that we don't see its pathology, you know, as directly as we see the pathology of epilepsy. We don't see the muscle movement and the fall and the loss of consciousness. And yet, the abnormalities in the brain in depression have many parallels to the abnormalities in epilepsy.
Mm. Well, that does get at the some of the things perhaps about depression that make it difficult for people to think about. That is, we cannot identify a specific disease-causing agent, for example. There's no depression germ.
Right.
And that there are some things about the way that it works that seem to be a little bit mysterious. There are, you know, we can't implicate environmental toxins. We can't implicate lifestyle features. We can't say, well, it was because you had too much fat in your diet or because you smoked cigarettes. I mean, it's very difficult to point to why someone would develop depression, and indeed to because you can go out and you can find people who come from very difficult, disadvantaged life circumstances, people who were abused children, people who experienced extreme levels of stress and trauma. And you can find some people who suffer greatly because of that. And then you can find some people who seem to be able to make it. And you have to ask, and then you ask that question, well, what's the difference between these two people? Why did the one person just burn out and crash, and this other person, while you might say their life is not perfect, they're not without pain, they managed to make it okay? It seems to make it a very mysterious, you can't grab hold of it, very mysterious thing.
Well, you know, there are so many reasons you put on the table for making those distinctions, and but I think it's worth looking at each of them. For instance, we don't really require of diseases that we know a specific virus or a specific environmental cause for them. We don't really know what causes colon cancer. We don't certainly know what causes multiple sclerosis. These things occur. We, you know, are a little bit aware of what's going on in the relevant organs. We're a little bit aware of the relationship between those changes and the symptoms that people have. But we really don't know the basic causes of many, many diseases. So that doesn't seem to be a disqualification. And that idea that many people have trauma and do well with it, and I think that's true, most people will never get depression, almost regardless of what happens in the environment. There are people who were in the concentration camps who never got depressed, so far as we can tell. Rare, but I mean that occurs. But that very thing is characteristic of diseases, after all, which is to say that there's some vulnerability that some people carry that makes them different as human beings, as mammals, than the other ones. And those people are the ones who, in the face of trauma, will get the changes in the brain and the heart and the blood vessels and so on. Don't. That is very characteristic of disease. So, you know, I think that depression is, as I say, ordinary in this regard. And I think really what has made it all the more ordinary in the past 10 years, and I think close the argument that was open before then, is these different sets of studies that show there really are different things that are different in the brain of depressives, and those differences aren't normal variants. Those differences are things that have gone wrong in the brain. You know, I think that evidence in the past 10, really the past 6 or 7 years, has been decisive for that argument. Once you see those things, there's no argument anymore. So why does the argument continue? Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One is political, that in the 1950s, Thomas Szasz and his followers had this myth of mental illness argument. And what they meant by the myth of mental illness was depression, this is a simplification, but basically depression is treated by psychotherapy, and you shouldn't ever force people to have psychotherapy because you're forcing them to change their minds about things. There was, after all, this very odd treatment for depression, which is you would work with people on their memory and their character and their personality and their characteristic responses to challenges, and then the disease would get better. And, of course, for most diseases, we don't recommend personality change. Medicine likes to treat people. I mean, it might be if you have a different personality, you're less likely to get tuberculosis. There were some studies years ago about personality style and tuberculosis. But, you know, medicine is parsimonious. It likes to attract diseases more directly. And so I think that this was an anti-fascist, anti-communist politics, very respectable, which tried to keep disease out of the mental illness out of the category of disease, and, you know, didn't want the Soviets to lock up people because they were paranoid, when really what was going on was they opposed the government. And that all is legitimate, but it doesn't stand in the way of this current evidence that their brain changes in depression, A, and B, you know, we have reasonably parsimonious treatments that work for a lot of people. Many people, you just give them medicine and they get better. And then my book is, by the way, not at all a brief for medication as opposed to psychotherapy. People do also get better with psychotherapy, and the combination is the best, and insurance companies really ought to pay for the combination of medication and psychotherapy better than they do. You know, but that said, that particular set of arguments resisting depression status is a set of political arguments, and normally in medicine we don't accept that kind of argument as decisive. And I think then there are other arguments now where there are social workers and psychiatric nurses and psychologists and so on who really value psychotherapy so primarily that they worry that the incorporation of depression fully into the disease category will interfere with their practicing what they value and believe in. So I think there's that another set of arguments which has to do with healthcare politics, and it's interesting and important, and as I say, I'm in some ways in favor of the goals of those the people making those arguments, but I think they're wrong. I think depression is a disease. I mean, they're wrong about attacking the politics at that stage of the argument.
Well, if one accepts the idea that depression is the result of the way an individual responds to life stresses and conditions in their life, then don't you still have to, I think some people would argue that if you take that person, you take them out of that set of conditions and you provide them perhaps some sort of therapy and some sort of medication, if then they get better, but you put them back in the same situation again, they're just going to go back to where they were. I mean, don't you have to still make some effort to not only change the life circumstances and the stressors the person is exposed to, but also change the way that they respond to those? And does that not require some personality change or adjustment in the individual that goes beyond what you can do by adjusting their brain chemistry with medication?
Well, I mean, if a person characteristically say got heart attacks or high blood pressure or asthma in those stressful situations, all the things you say would be true, but we don't think that heart attacks or asthma or or high blood pressure, if we think of it in that way, we don't any the less think of them as diseases because they, might not appear in certain environments or might appear less if somebody had were less anxious or had a different personality style. I mean, that just is very common for any of these diseases that are affected both by mind and body, which, frankly, is most diseases. So I think it's really the fact that the symptoms are also mental, or that the symptoms that we see most prominently are mental, that makes us think differently about depression, not the fact that the causes are various, in the ways that you say. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I mean, I happen to think that most of what you're saying is true, that depression is a chronic, recurrent disease, and that people who have needed psychotherapy in the past may need more psychotherapy in the future, and if they've needed medicine in the past, they may need more medicine in the future. They may need ongoing therapy, ongoing medication. But I will say that as we say that, in a certain sense, it means that we have not had great faith in the medicines of the psychotherapy. It certainly was believed, even 10 years ago, that very often you could give a course of medication or give a course of psychotherapy and people would be, very substantially better for long periods of time. And I would, of course, there are some people of whom that's just true.
We are already at the midpoint. We have some callers. I want to bring them into the conversation and also want to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Peter Kramer. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University, author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac. He is also the host of the public radio mental health program The Infinite Mind, and he is the author of a new book that explores here the territory that we've been talking about this morning. The title of this book is Against Depression, and it's published by Viking. Questions and comments are welcome. The only thing we ask people to do is just try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have several callers here. We'll start with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm moved to ask a somewhat optimistic question. There are disorders, there are states which in excess require treatment. It's reasonable to shut off a lot of peripheral functions when you have an emergency and you have to move quickly or do something quickly, and you don't necessarily need liver function or even digestion or other things for some brief period of time. But in a person whose liver function is depressed, whose digestion is wrong, whose, I don't want to call them peripheral, but something other than immediate functions, if that goes wrong, we have a disorder. But we don't say that we should look for people who never shut down their digestion or never shut down their liver function, because being able to go from one state to another is a good thing for us.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. When I wrote Listening to Prozac, the prevailing model was sort of a chemical imbalance model that has been now so judiciously discussed by Tom Cruise and others.
Think of cutting off the gut as a chemical imbalance.
The current model really is a bit downstream from that. Yes, there are problems with serotonin and norepinephrine and these other chemicals that lead to depression. But more immediately, it looks as if the problem is that most people can have these stress reactions for a while and shut them off then later. And what happens in people who are depressed is that the stress hormones keep pouring out so that it's a stuck switch problem. They have an inability to shut down stress responses. And when that happens, you start endangering nerve cells in the brain. You start getting these problems in memory and concentration. You start endangering the heart and the blood vessels and the bones and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, depressed women who've had chronic recurrent depression have less calcium in their bones than women who haven't. Parts of their brain are smaller relative to the women who haven't. So that it is the chronicity of that response. I think you're exactly right. Here's a response that in the acute situation is reasonable. There certainly are comparable reactions that are perfectly normal, like grief, where not only do you have depressive symptoms, you have anxious symptoms, all sorts of things go wrong in the acute grieving process, and then people get better. And in fact, some things in grieving people get better very quickly. So, they're left with a scattering of of problems to deal with, and you know, of course, all the real outflow of whatever loss they've had. But people with depression don't have that resilience. Depression is not a disease that involves sadness primarily. It's a disease that primarily involves a loss of mental resilience on a lot of fronts: memory, concentration, mood, and you know, just the ability to get accompanying biochemical things back to normal. So that's right. I mean, I don't think you're making the argument I'm making, but I think I'm largely agreeing with you.
Okay.
Yes, to have these responses in moderation or acutely is very useful. And the only problem in depression is they go on and on, and that leads to all kinds of damage and to the syndrome that we see. And by the way, if you see depression, it's a very convincing disease. If you see someone sitting in a chair, wringing your hands, repeatedly saying these self-accusatory, sad things that externally people would say are not a realistic view of her circumstances, unable to take good care of her children, unable to go to work, and so on, you know, you understand just sitting there that you're in the face of something very abnormal, and that has a degree and a persistence and so on that's beyond what an ordinary response to adversity involves.
So the other side of this coin then, and I know it's a bit out of the field, but you seem to have amassed an awful lot of data, worldwide, when you study cultures that have stylized grieving or mm-hmm. or normative grieving processes,
yeah.
when do they expect the hump to be over and the recovery to come? I'll
yeah.
hang up now and,
right.
and listen to this discussion, because that's where I was headed.
Yeah. Grieving is really seems to be a separate problem from depression. Grieving, of course, is universal. Most people are subject to grieving. And cultures, as the caller says, have very varied norms, so that if in rural Greece, you are predeceased by your husband or your son, you will, you know, dress in black, you'll do very little for a year or 2 years, lots of things will be done for you, and you may wear black for the rest of your life if you're a woman. So that, you know, that people don't expect the grieving widow or mother to be back to ordinary functioning ever again. I mean, there are functions, but not the functioning of someone who'd never had that experience. Whereas in our culture, you know, after a few weeks, we want you to get back to work, and after certainly 6 months or a year, we want you to be perfectly, you know, functioning as if this had never occurred. So those expectations differ, and the people who do well in those cultures differ too. Very resilient women really chafe at the requirements of rural Greek mourning, and very sensitive people who are prone to depression do poorly in our culture. So. It's true that cultural expectations help frame, you know, what's normal in the mourning process. They help also create people who have trouble with that process.
Let's talk again with someone else here. Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Yes, I'm very fascinated from personal experience with this question of whether depression is a disease. And do you think in part we get into this conundrum because we draw the dichotomy between, quote, physical diseases like diabetes, heart attack, or heart disease, and kidney disorders and cancer, and, quote, mental disease like depression and schizophrenia. And before you know it, one gets labeled as a stigmatic part of our culture, whereby another, and both manifest themselves physically, gets accepted. Is that a problem we have?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think that the fact that we now know that depression is a physical disease, you know, my notion is that that does close the case, that, you know, the fact that occasionally, and this is not uniformly the case, but occasionally a pathologist could look at the brain of someone who had died and say, in his or her life, this person suffered recurrent depression without any interview with the person, without, you know, testimony. So, you know, that I think that we are a culture where that is particularly convincing. We want the physical manifestations, not to say that, you know, if someone has severe back pain and there's nothing visible on CT or MRI scan, that we absolutely dismiss that as not being disease. You know, we don't always need the evidence. But, yes, I think that is difficult for the culture. But I think, you know, I think we've crossed the line in this case. And I do think we see schizophrenia as a disease. I think depression is sort of the holdout, that even manic depression is much more generally understood clearly to be a disease in our culture than simple, straightforward major depression is.
And if, as a follow-up, it seems that major institutions in our society, including medicine, including pharmacy, including insurance companies, especially insurance companies who, in terms of offering benefits, seem to offer a more truncated benefit for depression and other mental disorders as opposed to those, you know, traditionally physical disorders I just alluded to.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's outrageous. I think if you have cancer and somebody came up to you and said, look, the kind of cancer you have is best treated with radiotherapy, radiation therapy, you know, and pharmacotherapy drugs. But we're only going to give you the drugs. The radiation therapy is too expensive. We worry about it. No radiation therapy for you. You'd be outraged. This company would be driven out of business by the government and the patients and so on. But we do say that with depression. We say it's best treated with medication and psychotherapy. We'll pay for the medication, you know, up to a point, selected medicines on a roster, and we'll pay very little, if anything, for psychotherapy given by poorly trained, you know, quasi-professionals. I mean, it is outrageous. And I think that part of the reason for being clear about depression as a disease is being clear that, well, it should be covered by insurance companies the way all diseases are. It certainly causes suffering, disability. It causes all the other conditions that down the road that the insurance companies are going to have to pay for, or somebody's going to have to pay for, like heart disease. You know, if you have had a heart attack and you are depressed after the heart attack, you have a worse prognosis than if you have congestive heart failure after the heart attack.
Wow.
Depression is a terrible risk factor in cardiac disease.
Right.
In some of these studies, 4, 5, and 6 times as likely to have a recurrence of whatever cardiac outcome it is if you're depressed.
And what about postpartum depression?
That seems like a very clear case. I mean, it's odd that, you know, Tom Cruise and Brooke Shields are at it over this. It seems so clear if you quickly change the hormonal status of some women, they get depression. We talked about, do we know the causes of depression? Well, we have some pretty good ideas about postpartum depression. There are depressions that come on in old age that are a result of so-called silent strokes. They're silent in the sense that they don't cause you to lose your ability to walk or use your arms and so on, and they don't cause you to lose your vision or hearing. They're not silent. They're causing depression. That strokes in the very parts of the brain that have the pathology and run-of-the-mill depression, strokes in those parts of the brain can cause depression in old age. And there we know the pathology very directly. It's the strokes. It's the lack of brain tissue. And, you know, I think it's very clear that those are diseases, even though the symptoms of that post-stroke depression identical. Those are identical to the symptoms of the depression you get from genetics and early trauma and later adversity and so on.
Well, thank you, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Let us continue. We'll go next to someone here locally in Champaign-Urbana, line number 3.
Hi. I'm a middle-aged man, and I've obviously a man, but I've suffered from depression, and the trigger really was job performance, and I was diagnosed after the depression with ADD, and I was diagnosed very late in life. And so you're talking about clear-cut triggers in some ways, and I've come to think that the trigger for my depression was this long-term dissatisfaction with performance. And I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I wonder if there's been any work, and I assume it would be very difficult to do, but any work on the ecological context of the disorder, and if the rapid changes the human race has gone through in a very short evolutionary period of time can account for a growth in depression?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear your voice. I should say this about my book, that it's partly a storytelling book and about stories of people with depression. And I think that we just understand the disease very, almost hear someone's voice and you can say, gee, I understand there may be something going on or that has gone on in the past. Ecology and depression. I'm not a great fan of evolutionary biology.
Oh, really?
But I discuss these issues in the book. I'll tell you some reasons why I'm not a fan. The evolutionary biologists largely want diseases to have evolutionary function. Some do, some don't. Of course, some are going to have some function in the hunter-gatherer phase of humanity. Some are going to be sort of engineering failures where you engineer for a good immune system, and when you have a failure, you get these autoimmune diseases. And I think depression is more the second kind, where when you engineer for things like empathy and connection and attachment, you're going to get some of these problems where nature just hasn't taken into account lots of things. And among other things, we live long lives, and so we're more prone to erosion in these systems. But the evolutionary biologists have said some interesting things. One thing they've said is that, look, there are conditions like drought and famine where we want to signal to the animal to stop foraging. So it goes back to the cave, and that depression really disables the animal so that in the face of this adversity, chronic adversity, the animal becomes disabled in a certain way that conserves energy. And that seemed like an interesting argument until people looked at depressed people and saw that they really, one of the things they do is they keep doing things that are not productive. That depression precisely involves sticking to tasks repetitively, without any outcome, and that depressives really don't stop foraging. They keep foraging badly.
Yeah.
And so then it was said, well, really it's different, that these major investments in life, like marriage or career, and that you oughtn't to be easily discouraged from them, that people ought to be programmed to keep banging their head against the wall or gnawing the same old bone, because in these areas of major commitment, at least some of the time on an evolutionary basis, it's good to obsessionally stick with them. Well, of course, that left, that's exactly the kind of argument that isn't convincing, that depression exists on an evolutionary basis because it encourages persistence and because it encourages persistence. You have to walk a very narrow line to get the evolutionary benefit out of it.
No, I think you're talking about evolutionary biology in terms of total adaptationist type explanations, and I know it's a disorder, and I don't look for adaptive reasons for it. I just was thinking that with we've become less connected to a clan, less nurturing in our social makeup over the last 2,000 years, and that perhaps depression is more common now because we're not we're unable to be the nurturing social primates that we were, and so not that there's an evolutionary adaptation that's called depression. It's that there is this malady that's more common because we don't...
No, you are in the majority. This is what I think many, many psychiatrists think, that we're just a less connected culture. There are fewer opportunities for nurturing and being nurtured and so on. I must say I'm one of the few who... I'm just not sure that that's right. There's an old German sociology argument about which is really more adaptive for human beings, the anonymous big city or the close-knit small town. And, of course, it turns out the close-knit small town has so much stereotyping, so much limitation of opportunity, so many outsiders who are not given their due, and that the city, for all its alienation, has many niches and many opportunities for people who are peculiar in certain ways. So it's a tough argument. It's an argument on both sides.
Right.
And I think that it's like that Greek widow thing where that kind of long-term nurturance and permission for mourning is adaptive for some people, it's oppressive for others. So I just don't know. I don't think that necessarily depression is on the rise. I think we're more aware of it. I think that's a good thing. I think we'll save many lives and a lot of misery by being more aware of it. I'm just not sure that the culture is to blame.
Well, thank you. I'll read your book.
Oh, thanks for the call. We're getting into about our last 10 minutes here, and there's one other point that I want to have you talk at least a little bit about, and that is another one of these reasons that perhaps it's difficult for us to think about mental illness as a disease, and that is that that we have this tendency to link our various dysfunctionalities, particularly the more minor ones, with identity, and
right.
that we see them not so much as something that it's not something that we have, but something that we are.
We are, right.
And that makes it, you know, that if you think about it that way, you perhaps will think differently about the question, what do we do about it? How do we
yes.
treat it? And then that one of those big questions you ask about, well, if we could get rid of it, then
right.
would we have lost something?
I think that is one reason. I mean, part of the book I wrote about the long history of melancholy and the number of romantic ideas that are attached to the notion of melancholy. But I start the book on a fairly upbeat note, which is stories of patients who recover rapidly from depression for whatever reason, even before these newer medications. People would sometimes just walk in and say on a given day, I'm better. And when people are better, they very rarely do they continue to think that the depression was part of their identity. I think part of the impediment to depression getting treated is that when people are depressed, they think, this is who I am, I'm worthless, I deserve it, I'm guilty anyway, of course I should suffer. Everyone else is suffering. They see the world through a dusky lens. The normal human state is to be a little rosy, a little inaccurate on the side of optimism. And that when people are flung back into this normal state, they say it was a disease. You know, they say, but I think in the state, when you are depressed, one reason people don't go for treatment is they think it is their fate or their just desserts. It's a disease that contains this level of self-accusation that makes it hard for people to leave it. And that sets in fairly rapidly. You have people with these rapid onset depressions where the wife will say, you know, 2 weeks ago he thought he was fine, and now he only says these terrible things about himself. So that you get immersed in it very rapidly. It's one of these brain states that's very convincing.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Peter Kramer. He's clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University. The ideas here we're talking about this morning you can find in his book, Against Depression, which is out recently. It's published by Viking. We have some other callers here. We'll see how many we can get in the time that remains. Next up is someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. When you spoke about the rural Greek widows, what about the men? Do they get to have a year or 2 years of not functioning fully and they get taken care of for the rest of their lives when they lose their wives?
No. I mean, I think there is this very widespread cultural prejudice against men showing the signs of grieving for very long or showing depression. You know, the man is supposed to remarry and go about his business. It's not sexually equal at all.
So, therefore, that means it's not really physical. It's really only cultural.
Well, it doesn't mean that these men don't suffer. And as I say, it doesn't mean that all the women really do suffer in the way that the social form expects them to. I think that particular mourning ritual has actually a great deal to do with the different roles of men and women in the culture.
Okay, I got one quick one.
Yeah.
When I had the virus this spring, I didn't care about anything for months. And finally, I felt better.
Yeah.
Is that a normal thing after a virus? Did you feel just depressed, or is that not depression, that's something else?
Well, I think it is probably depression, but maybe you're someone who's, you know, resilient and you're not likely to get the kind of major depression I've talked about. But yes, I think infectious diseases can often set off depressions in people who are vulnerable to them, and that thing that you were experiencing with that virus probably is, you know, as close as you're going to get to depression. It's probably a very similar state. I do have a discussion in the book of these chemicals called cytokines, which are thought to be responsible for the depression in infectious diseases. There's some medicines that are given. There are medicines that are given for hepatitis and for other diseases that cause that same kind of depression. And actually, people die because they're unable to take those medicines because they're so depressing for them.
Mm. Okay.
And the people who have those responses are often very similar. That is to say, they're people with family histories of depression, some level of depression even before the medicine was given, some adversity in their lives, and so on. It seems to be that, you know, it's that last trigger that sets off the syndrome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I've got two questions. I was watching a reality TV show called Hooking Up, and in it, 20, 30-year-olds get together, and they've had trouble meeting other people, and this one guy was telling this girl he just met on the first date that he was kind of getting depressed because every time he'd go out with a girl, he'd find out that she was on Paxil.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you're one of the people who coined the phrase cosmetic psychopharmacology.
I am the person, I believe, yep.
Yeah, by which people use chemicals to take on whatever personality they might prefer.
Right.
And
by the way, I didn't say that in a favorable light. I think, you know, when you say cosmetic, you're saying that you're holding it at a little distance and saying, hey, wait a minute, we ought to look at what the implications are.
Yeah, well, it sounds, anyway, my question is it true that that there's huge numbers of people in New York City taking Paxil, Prozac-type drugs? And
yeah.
Two, I understand that that the FDA looked at ecstasy as a possible medical uses recently, and I was just wondering what happened there and, you know, this whole area about taking it on a regular basis to change your personality. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah. When I wrote Listening to Prozac, I was concerned about a future possibility, really sort of mild science fiction, about what if medicines were used to alter personality, since it seemed to me there was some personality alteration beyond even the recovery from disease in some of these patients I treated. I don't think I'm seeing that day to day. There are a lot of people taking antidepressants in urban areas. There are a lot in rural areas. There, you know, are a lot in Europe. There are a number in Asia. It's really, these medicines do work for some people. You know, I think that is the reason that they're so popular. And, you know, I think they have a different range of side effects than the older medicines and ones that we mostly tolerate better. But I have not seen these cosmetic uses, even though I worried about them. And I'm sort of in an odd way, my email and phone seem to be a clearinghouse for stories about antidepressant medications. In my office, and really in any of the cases where I've followed up and gotten more information, I haven't seen frivolous uses of antidepressants. It looks to me that the people on them very largely have depression or they have anxiety disorders or there are other uses now. Sometimes they're used in smoking cessation and so on. But I haven't seen these arbitrary uses. Ecstasy, I can say less about. I mean, on the face of it, ecstasy seems so harmful in certain ways that I don't know that it will be ever widely used as a legitimate medication.
We are just about out of time, unfortunately. I wish we could continue. Just I want to give you maybe a minute or so if you could talk a little bit about what it is you think we should be doing as we approach depression. What should we do differently, do you think?
Yeah. I think, you know, on a medical and a public health basis, we'd like to recognize it quickly, treat it quickly, and then treat it very thoroughly. I think part of the new research shows that leaving depression half treated isn't very good, and you really want all the symptoms to get better, and that the way to do that for most people is a combination of medication and psychotherapy. Beyond that, you know, what my writing is about is my worry about this distance between what I call what it is, depression as it's defined through medicine and scientific approaches, and what it is to us, the depression that we think about as a sort of automatic habit of mind where we're not monitoring our thoughts and where we are much more dismissive of it and less likely to give it its due. I think it's time. I think, you know, that the research is far enough along that we can say it's a disease. We ought to treat it quickly. We ought to treat it well. And, you know, we ought to make all the social and workplace accommodations we make for other diseases for people who suffer from depression when they do.
Well, again, for people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled Against Depression. It's published by Viking, by our guest, Dr. Peter Kramer. You also might want to go back and look at the book that really made him well-known, Listening to Prozac, now 12 years old. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University and also hosts a public radio mental health program called The Infinite Mind. Dr. Kramer, thank you very much.
Thank you.